The following is a Reels Channel and Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit Spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Hey, I'm Steve Helling, senior reporter for Murder Made Me Famous, Reels Channel's true crime program on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Be sure to download the Podcast One app and subscribe to our series. Then go to Reels.com, that's Reels.com, to find true crime TV series like this one on Reels Channel.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
He is one of the most infamous and prolific serial killers America has ever known.
He had told us that he killed 33 people.
His methodology is heinous.
He was luring young boys into his basement and raping, torturing, and then killing them.
And his alter ego, infamous.
He visited children's hospitals dressed as clown.
Stephen King's book It featured a killer clown, but that was just fiction. John Wayne Gacy was a killer clown, and it was all too real. Behind the grease paint smile was a lust for murder.
He taunts police on his trail.
Hey, you want to know a secret? Clowns can get away with murder.
Until authorities finally unearth a horrifying discovery.
I think this whole crawl space is full of kids.
There was more than one victim here, but we had no idea it was going to be 33.
The killer reveals disturbing details to the detectives on the case.
During the confession, we had found out that not only did he torture his victims, but after he killed his victims, he would stick their underwear down their throat.
And new theories suggest that the body count might be higher than originally believed.
There may be other angles out there that are unresolved.
Meet John Wayne Gacy.
Hey there!
A small-time politician and part-time clown until murder made him famous. When numerous bodies were found underneath John Wayne Gacy's home, the media was on the scene to report every grisly detail.
Former detective Mike Albrecht.
And that was the headlines for every day, his second, third body, eighth body.
The number of bodies found today are six.
Bringing the total to
21.
Things took an even stranger turn when it was revealed that the man behind the murders would frequently dress as a clown and entertain children.
John Wayne Gacy is part of the reason why many people have coulrophobia, a fear of clowns. Gacy inspired a number of films, and in the 1992 movie To Catch a Killer, he was played by Brian Dennehy. Brian Dennehy claimed that he got a letter from John Wayne Gacy saying that Dennehy was his favorite actor, but he didn't know why he would take part in a movie that he called a fraud of a film.
Gacy will forever be known as one of the most infamous serial killers in history. But what shaped this man into a monster whose deeds still horrify people today?
The Gacys lived in a middle-class neighborhood in northern Chicago. John had an older sister named Joanne, and one younger sister, Karen.
Filmmaker, serial killer culture, John Borowski.
Gacy Sr. was kind of a tough Polish guy growing up in Chicago. And he drank a lot. There were stories where he would go down into the basement and drink brandy, and that's the way he would deal with his problems.
Nightly dinners keep the Gacy children on pins and needles.
The
This isn't warm. You hear me? It's cold!
Forensic social worker Tricia Phelps.
His father, it was well known, was horribly physically abusive, was verbally abusive, very denigrating to the young John Wayne Gacy.
John's father had a temper, and John would catch the worst of it if his father ever thought he was doing girl activities.
Gacy's father wanted him to go and play ball or play football, and young John Wayne Gacy wanted to stay home and cook with his sisters or go garden with his mom.
What are you gardening again?
Didn't I tell you that's for sissies?
He would become outraged when he would see Gacy interested in anything like either flowers or fashion, you know, anything that wasn't manly.
John does his best to please his father, so the 12-year-old joins the Boy Scouts. However, young John already has some secrets that come to light when his mother makes a startling discovery.
John? John, what are you doing over there?
Former detective Dave Hockmeister.
Gacy liked the feel of his mother's silk panties. His sister even mentioned that she did see him with these panties at some point when he was a child.
At the same time John is exploring his feminine side, he is having bouts of sickness at school.
Gacy had many health issues. He'd be sent home for having seizures or blackouts. I feel they were primarily because of his father's beating him, hitting him on the head.
By 1964, 22-year-old Gacy is working as a shoe salesman and becomes active in the community by joining the local chapter of the JCs.
Gacy wanted to become a prominent member of the community. It was him trying to have this sense of power and being in control of these different campaigns that he started.
He meets a shy bookkeeper named Marlon.
Marlon's family was better off than the Gacys, and her father owned 3 Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants. Gacy allegedly saw this as a way to get ahead.
After less than a year of dating, they marry in September of 1964.
John Wayne Gacy's father-in-law felt something was off about Gacy, and he tried to persuade her as much as he could not to marry him.
1965 proves to be a banner year for Gacy. The JCs honor him as Man of the Year, and his wife, Marlon, becomes pregnant with their first child. Then in February 1966, while Marlon is in the hospital in labor, Gacy goes out to a bar to celebrate with a colleague.
What do you think? Should we buy him a couple drinks, see what happens?
John, your approach to getting laid is all wrong. At best, you've got a 50-50 chance of finding a girl and getting laid. You see, if you strike out with a woman, you should get yourself a man.
Gacy allegedly accompanies his friend home.
...100% success rate.
What? What are you doing? No.
And this is Gacy's first homosexual encounter.
After Gacy's first encounter with a man, he heads to the hospital to be with his wife and firstborn.
Gacy was really affectionate with his newborn son, and that's not something he learned from his dad. Being a father seemed to come really naturally to him.
John gains the one thing he always wanted in life.
When Gacy, through marriage, achieved the things that he achieved for the first time in his life, I think he finally got a little bit of approval from his father, and therefore that approval translated for Gacy into love and a feeling like he mattered.
Later in 1966, John and Marlon moved to Waterloo, Iowa, about 100 miles outside of Des Moines.
John Wayne Gacy's father-in-law offered him a management job at the KFC in Iowa. This gave Gacy the opportunity to have a position of power, and he wanted everyone to refer to him as Colonel, which they did.
Gacy also joined the local Jaycees in Waterloo, and he rose up in the ranks really quickly, becoming the chairman of the membership drive.
John takes his new role very seriously and is committed to growing the Jaycees membership.
In order to bring in new members, Gacy would invite other men to these parties where there would be prostitutes. And by hosting these orgies at hotels and showing stag films, Gacy shows his own importance. And he's the cool guy now. This gives him this sense of importance and prominence with the other members of the Jaycees.
Providing sexual favors gives Gacy a notoriety that allows him to sign up 20 new members in one evening. Gacy even wins a vice president position with the Waterloo Jaycees in 1967. Gacy and wife Marlon welcome their second child that same year. Gacy appears to be a normal family man, but he has hidden desires.
When Gacy worked at the KFC, he had access to a huge pool of potential victims.
Gacy whets his sexual appetite by preying on innocent young men he hires for odd jobs. 15-year-old Donald Voorhees, the son of a prominent local politician, is one of those boys.
Because, of course, he was in charge of hiring new workers. And who would he hire? Mostly these young men. And these young men, if they weren't working there at the KFC with him, they would be helping him possibly with other projects.
Yeah, it's, just doing a little bit of research for the sex education committee that I'm part of. That might sound good.
Okay.
Yeah?
Gacy started what he called these experiments with one of his victims, Donald Voorhees. He was only 15 years old.
Gacy then treating him probably more like an adult than anyone in Donald's life was treating him. At the same time, Gacy's introducing him to alcohol and probably hard liquor. And then you throw on top of it, Gacy offering him $50 to perform oral sex. $50 in 1970 would have seemed like a fortune.
But soon, John Wayne Gacy's secret sexual obsessions will grow violent and lead to horrific ends for dozens of victims. By 1968, John Wayne Gacy has begun luring young boys into his home and paying them in return for sexual favors.
Okay. One of Gacy's young victims was named Donald Voorhees, and he came from a very influential family.
In March 1968, Donald comes clean to his father, an Iowa senator, when Gacy's name is mentioned.
So, how is it working for John Gacy?
Fine, I guess.
He wants me to be his campaign manager, but I'm kind of on the fence.
Dad, I really, really don't think that that's a good idea.
Why?
Voorhees felt uncomfortable enough that he confessed to his father what Gacy had been doing to him. Donald and his father then went to the police, and they arrested Gacy for sodomy.
Gacy takes two polygraph tests and says that he hasn't engaged in homosexual activity. The polygraph results show otherwise. Gacy is arrested and charged with sodomy. He is sentenced to 10 years in prison in Anamosa State Penitentiary. Gacy's world is crumbling as his wife, Marlon, threatens to leave him.
I'm not agreeing to a divorce. Your father's telling you lies.
Gacy reportedly never sees his wife or children again. In prison, Gacy is very social, even singing in the prison choir and becoming the head chef.
He was considered the model inmate. He got a job in the kitchen and was considered to be quite the prison cook. He followed all of the rules to the letter and did it better than anybody else to such a degree that everybody kind of thought, well, he made a bad decision and we're not going to punish him for the rest of his life over it, so we're going to go ahead and let him out.
While Gacy was in prison, he was evaluated by a prison psychologist. And that psychologist said he most likely would not be committing any further antisocial acts in the future.
On June 18, 1970, John Wayne Gacy is released from prison after serving less than 2 years. He moves back to Chicago, and in with his mother, he joins the local chapter of the J.C.'s.
When Gacy returned to Chicago, he started a construction company called PDM, and his primary employment source were boys between the ages of, say, 14 and 25.
In May of 1971, John is dating Carol Hoff, a divorcee and mother of two daughters. After a brief courtship, Carol and her daughters move in with Gacy.
This is part of the serial killer duality, where he was kind to her daughters. They called him daddy. They accepted him as their father.
Doting family man or not, John Wayne Gacy has a secret sex life, one that he indulges by picking up young men. But in January 1972, while Carol is out, Gacy's insatiable lust for teenage boys takes a grisly turn.
John went to the bus station looking for a hookup. There, he met Timothy Jack McCoy, who was coming home from Christmas vacation.
Gacy and McCoy spend the night together. The next morning, while McCoy is making breakfast, Gacy sees a knife in his hand and perceives it to be a threat.
What are you doing?
God! No!
Crazy!
No! 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 Please stop! Please!
So he stabbed him to death. And he said blood was everywhere. He didn't realize how much blood could come out of a person.
Gacy will later claim to have had an orgasm during the killing.
And he said at the time his wife was out for the day, so he had thrown the body in a crawl space real quick, and he went back and he started to clean up all the blood. And he said it took literally an hour to clean up all the blood. And he said he just had wiped up the last drop of blood when his wife walked in the front door.
Daddy!
Hi, girls. How are you? Oh, it's so good to see you.
Did you just clean the kitchen?
I sure did.
That's so sweet.
I'm glad you're home. Oh, it's good to see you.
It is good to see you.
I'm going to go play with those girls. Hey, girls, coming to get you.
Carol has no clue that John has just committed a murder. The couple marries in July 1972.
By marrying Carol, he hoped to acquire back all that had been taken from him during his incarceration.
But it doesn't take long for Carol to catch on to Gacy's odd behaviors.
Eventually, Carol sees evidence that Gacy was having sex and possibly, you know, doing other things with young men.
In the garage, she saw a mattress on the floor, and she also saw a pair of silk underwear that he had used while he was pleasuring himself. They apparently reminded him of his mother's.
Carol also discovers several wallets belonging to young men. She confronts her husband about her findings.
John. John, don't just walk away. I went into the garage. What is going on? Why do you have this wallet?
Why are you going through my things, Carol?
Carol complains to John about a foul odor coming from the crawl space. To mask the stench of the corpse, John covers it with cement. He will later enlist two employees to dig graves for future victims under the guise of creating plumbing trenches.
David Cram and Michael Rossi were two extremely loyal employees of John Wayne Gacy. They were very, very troubled kids, bad family life, the whole shot.
Hey, how you guys doing down there? You about done yet?
Not yet, John.
All right, well, now only dig where I marked. That's the only place that I want you to dig is where I marked.
We got it, John.
They were digging these trenches, but they're not stupid. You know, Gacy would told him it's because of its flooding situation and dampness in the crawl space. You know, after a while, I'm sure they had to think, what's going on here?
Then, on Mother's Day 1975, after less than 3 years of marriage, Gacy makes a shocking confession to Carol.
I can't do this.
Gacy tells his wife, guess what? I'm bisexual and we're never going to have sex again. Everything starts making sense to his wife. Why is there a mattress in a garage? Why is Gacy hanging around with young men? So this is all leading to a point where she just can't take this anymore.
Gacy and Carol's divorce is finalized in 1976. Now a single man, Gacy spends his free time dressing as Pogo the Clown and volunteering at children's hospitals.
Gacy created this persona of Pogo the Clown, which stood for Gacy being Polish and on the go, Pogo.
Oh, ta-da!
The magic tricks and dressing up as a clown gave him almost a way to recreate his childhood and to do nice things for these kids. It was, I think, all a part of the smoke and mirrors that was his life. I want you to look over here so that you don't see what's happening back here.
Gacy hosts huge costume parties to which he invites neighbors and powerful politicians.
Gacy would throw these big bashes where everyone would dress up, and he invited a lot of well-connected political people.
Because when you're in the public eye, nobody suspects you of doing anything wrong or underhanded.
John Wayne Gacy brazenly begins posing as a police officer to ensnare vulnerable young men. And in December 1977, his twisted ruse pays off.
Hey there. Hey! Can I see some ID? Get in the car, blow your head off. Just stay calm. Just stay calm. Now put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind your back. I'm going to put these on you. Now lean forward. Get these. Shut up. Shut up. Now get down to the floor. Shut up. Just shut up.
Robert Donnelly is taken to Gacy's home, where he is raped and tortured.
Gacy's torture of Robert Donnelly is indicative of a sadistic serial killer. He would dunk his head in water numerous times to the point where he would almost drown.
Gacy was pure evil, and this kid thought he was going to die.
Found it. You just tie like that. Get that in there. And then I get...
No, it's twist.
Just twist it. Like that.
And eventually, he just dumps Robert Donnelly somewhere and, you know, he wakes up.
He then gets the courage, decides to report it to the police.
Donnelly reports the assault, and Gacy is questioned by police. He admits to having what he calls slave sex with Donnelly, but he insists it was consensual. The police believe him, and no charges are filed. Little do the authorities know about the makeshift tomb in Gacy's crawlspace.
Many of Gacy's victims ended up in the crawl space beneath his home.
Meanwhile, Gacy keeps up the good guy in the community routine by dressing up as Pogo the Clown and entertaining sick children. But on March 22, 1978, he again concedes to his drive for destruction. Gacy goes on the hunt and finds Jeffrey Rignall. The killer lures him into his car with marijuana.
Appreciate it, buddy.
Sure.
Gacy put a chloroform rag over Jeffrey's mouth until he passed out. When he woke up, Jeffrey was in Gacy's house.
In between assaults, Jeffrey Rignall comes to and notices another man in the room. This strange mystery will resurface decades later.
Reynolds' report, corroborated by the police, was that after he was horribly and viciously raped by Gacy and chloroformed, he finds himself awake but disoriented and dumped in Lincoln Park.
Rignall is one of the few victims to escape the fate of being killed and buried in John Wayne Gacy's crawlspace. Gacy's reign of terror continues, and the killer clown's body count grows.
Steve Helling here. If you're wondering what leads police to John Wayne Gacy's tomb, you're about to find out. And if you want to see more stories like this on your TV, check out Reel's channel. There are horrifying real crime stories of murderers like Chris Watts. He's the Denver dad who killed his pregnant wife and daughters and thought he got away with it. Then check out the Reel's medical mystery series, Autopsy, that reveals what really killed football hero Aaron Hernandez and WWE superstar Chyna. Did you know that they both may have had the same brain injury? You can find Reels on your TV at Reels.com. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com. Then check the top of the screen to find Reels in your area.
Birthdays, anniversaries, holidays. These are the important dates most people tend to remember. But for you true crime fans, the Parcast Network remembers important dates in true crime history. Today in True Crime is the new daily podcast that takes you back to the biggest events in true crime that happened each and every day in history. Whether the crime is infamous or just plain interesting, there's a crime story for every day of the year. From August 31st, when Jack the Ripper committed his first murder in 1888, to October 3rd, when O.J. Simpson was acquitted in 1995, and even the death of infamous cult leader Charles Manson on November 19th, 2017. Today in True Crime is Parcast's first daily true crime podcast. You no longer have to wait weeks to get your true crime fix. And with new episodes each day, you'll never run out of true crime content again. Crime never takes a day off, and neither does Parcast. Follow Today in True Crime for free on Spotify and anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
After hours of being raped and tortured, John Wayne Gacy's victim, Jeffrey Rignall, is released.
Rignall, to his extraordinary credit, spends 3 days essentially waiting.
Rignall spots Gacy's car and he follows it to Gacy's home.
From there, he gets the license plate and reports it to the police, and the police issue a warrant.
Gacy is arrested and charged with battery. He is released on bail, and a trial date is set. In the meantime, Gacy begins working for the Democratic Party as a precinct captain, where he coordinates events for the community and even meets First Lady Rosalynn Carter.
Here was a guy who was active in his community. He even had his picture taken with First Lady Rosalynn Carter. No one knew that he had a double life that included murder.
The interesting thing about the picture of him with Rosalynn Carter is that he had a Secret Service pin on his lapel. That pin enabled him to get close to the president, which he shouldn't have been able to get because he was a convicted felon.
He's living this lie out in the open.
On December 11th, 1978, John Wayne Gacy meets with the owners of Nissan Pharmacy in a Chicago suburb to discuss construction work.
Gacy went into the pharmacy and gave the owners a bid, and that's where he saw Rob Peast. Rob had overheard Gacy talking about how much he paid high schoolers to work for him, and it was more than he was making at the pharmacy.
Outside, Gacy sees the young employee taking out the trash and strikes up a conversation.
Gacy tells Rob Peast that he'd like to hire him, but it's Rob's mom's birthday, and she's just come to pick him up from work.
Hey, Mom. Mom, this contractor wants to see me about a job.
Yeah, I'll just look around a bit.
Hey, when I'm done, we can go home and do your birthday.
While his mother waits inside the drugstore, Rob goes to Gacy's nearby home to discuss the job.
Ta-da!
How'd you do that?
Here, give me your hands. I'll show you. Get that one on. That one. Yeah.
What's the trick?
The trick is, Rob, not to be stupid. Everybody knows if you've got handcuffs, you've got to have a key to get out of them. So the question is, Rob, do you have a key? Are you stupid? I'll let the machine get it. God. That was your folks down at the pharmacy. Hey, Ralph, I worry about you. Better get you home, get you out of those cuffs. He said you'd do anything for money. Well, I ain't no fruit picker.
No, sir.
So,
How about I just rape you?
I thought you were gonna kill me, Mr. Gacy.
One more little chick for the road. This is a fun one. See, you put this on, and then you tie that, and then you just twist, see? You just twist, and you twist.
Gacy's phone continues to ring while Rob Peast takes his last breaths.
The final phone call was from Gacy's aunt, who said that his uncle was about to die at any moment. So Gacy left Rob Peast there and went to the hospital.
The Peast family is gravely concerned and search all night long for Rob while his mother sits by the phone.
I'd like to file a missing persons report, please. My son.
Missing persons at that time was a little bit more common. The 70s was a little bit more, kids were running off. And a lot of times, if any kind of a kid had a little background to him or something, he wasn't even put in a computer right away. Rob Peast, give credit to the initial officer that took the report, and then they got onto it right away and immediately got the opinion that this kid was a good kid and everything going for him, so he wouldn't run away.
The police pull up Gacy's arrest records based on his past history of sexual violence. They go to question him.
Here is a clown.
Hey, how you doing?
We'd like some help about a missing juvenile that was last seen at the pharmacy you were at last night.
Oh, yeah, I was down at the pharmacy for some work. I'd seen a couple boys, but that's it. I had to leave and get down there to the hospital where my dying uncle was, and I didn't make it in time. He passed away.
But since you were one of the last people to see Rob Peast alive, I'm going to need you to come down to the station and fill out a witness form.
I can't go down there. I got stuff to do. I'll come by later. I'll come by there.
Gacy took Rob Peast's body and wrapped it in an orange rug. He put it in his Oldsmobile and drove to the river to dispose of his body.
In the meantime, police discover Gacy's earlier conviction for sodomy, so they search for evidence that could link him to Rob Peast's disappearance.
After our first search warrant, we found about 3 driver's licenses out of his bedroom that came back to young men who, when we did a little research, we found out that they were reported as missing persons, and some of them had worked for John Wayne Gacy. So that was pretty disturbing to us. We felt that there were probably at least 2 or 3 other homicides besides our victim.
Police find no signs of Rob Peast, but they do find a receipt that belongs to him. So they place Gacy on 24-hour surveillance.
Gacy managed to evade the first surveillance team when Dave Hackmeister and Mike Albrecht got the assignment to search for Rob Peast.
Early on, we determined that John Wayne Gacy had probably been involved in his disappearance. Although we didn't know Rob Peast personally, we grew to know him through the investigation. We all had photos of him. You know, we felt like he was part of our family.
When we first started off watching Gacy, we were hoping we were going to find Rob Peast within the next day or so alive.
Police don't know that Gacy is responsible for murdering over 30 young men. But because they're determined to solve the Rob Peast case, they begin interviewing Gacy's associates, one of them his ex-wife.
Gacy's ex-wife Carol told them about a kid who used to work for him named John Bukovich, and how when he stopped coming around, Gacy told her that he'd run away from home.
Teenager John Bukovich will later be found dead under Gacy's garage. But until the discovery, police question as many of Gacy's employees as possible, including David Cram.
Did you ever notice anything unusual or suspicious around Gacy's home or property?
He had a couple of wallets in his garage with identification still in them. One license was still valid, I think, with a year left on it. He said they belonged to some people that were deceased.
Would you repeat that?
Deceased. No longer living.
Did you ever ask him how he knew that?
No.
Has Mr. Gacy ever shown you any jewelry?
John gave me a couple watches after I was late a few times. He was digging through a box of jewelry and handed them to me, saying you have no excuse to be late anymore.
Another employee of Gacy's named Michael Rossi tells police that a 17-year-old teen, Greg Godzik, disappeared about a week after he started working for Gacy.
David Cram and Michael Rossi, I always had the feelings that they at least knew of the murders. These kids were street smart. You know, I don't know how they could not know that Gacy was doing some bad things.
During a search of Gacy's house, police discover a class ring belonging to a missing 19-year-old named John Zick. The evidence is piling up. Rob Peast has been missing for approximately 5 days, and detectives know that they can't let John Wayne Gacy out of their sight.
The John Wayne Gacy investigation was very unique. It was not a covert surveillance. It was an overt surveillance, meaning he knew we were the police. He knew we were following him.
The first time I met Gacy, we started a conversation. He was kind of a braggart at the time.
Hey. Are you with the feds or what?
No. We're the Des Plaines Police Department. We're on a missing persons investigation.
Well, I don't know why you're following me. I'm a clown. I'm a registered clown. Say, you want to know a secret? Clowns can get away with murder.
He definitely said clowns can get away with murder.
The arrogant serial-killing clown hires an attorney to shut down the investigation. Now officers must work against the clock to stop John Wayne Gacy before even more young men are slaughtered. John Wayne Gacy is a suspect in the disappearance of several young men, but he files a temporary restraining order against the police that threatens to hamper their investigation. On December 19th, 1978, 8 days after Rob Peast's disappearance, detectives get the break in the case they've been hoping for.
Detectives determined that the photo receipt that they obtained from the first search warrant had been in Rob Peast's pocket the night he disappeared, which proved that Rob Peast had been in Gacy's house. And that was enough for them to get a second, more thorough search warrant.
While officers wait for the search warrant to be issued, the surveillance team tails Gacy.
We didn't want to get too friendly with him, so we just decided that we wouldn't go into his house.
On the other hand, the other team was okay with it, and they did, in fact, go in there, and it actually played out very well for her investigation. When Ron Robinson and Bob Schultz, the other team, had been following Gacy, they were actually invited in by John. While he was in the washroom, the heat kicks on, and he said as soon as the heat kicked on, he got this really bad smell.
Oh, my God.
And he says right away, he equated that smell to the county morgue.
They're in the crawl space!
He said the hair went up on the back of his neck.
But police are unable to search Gacy's house until a second search warrant is issued. So the next night, the surveillance team follows Gacy to his attorney's office.
We were there maybe about an hour, and Mike got on the radio, the portable radio, and he says, "Hey, Dave, you'll never guess what. The attorneys want us to come in." He said, "They're being real nice to us all of a sudden. They haven't been nice to us all week." We suspected that he had confessed to his attorneys and they needed some police in there.
I didn't mean to. The first kid, he had a knife in my kitchen, and I thought he was going to kill me.
They looked really nervous, and that led cops to suspect that maybe he had confessed to the murders right before they got there.
It just confirmed the fact to us that they were scared to death and that this guy had to have confessed.
Yo, we're glad you guys are here. Don't let him go.
So the attorneys actually said to us, "Hey, if he tries to flee,
block his car and shoot his tires out if you have to.
But whatever you do, don't let him go." At this point, we're thinking maybe 4, 5, or 6 murders.
But officers can't detain Gacy legally yet, so they tail him to a nearby gas station. Gacy's next move gives cops the reason they need to nail the killer without a warrant.
Told Mike on the radio, I said, "Mike, we got a little bit of a drug transaction here."
"What did John give you?"
And we decided that we're not going to do anything about it right now. We'll put it in our back pocket and see what happens.
City Prosecutor Terry Sullivan gives the order to arrest Gacy for the drugs.
"Guys, what are you doing? This is ridiculous.
John Gacy,
you are under arrest for marijuana. What are you doing? Come on. Oh, what did I do? You can live with me. What are you doing? Now, wait a minute. What did I do? Come on. What did I do? Ow!
John didn't say anything at the time of his arrest for the drug transaction. At this point in juncture, he's not changing clothes for the last couple days. He's got like a 3-day beard. He's really looking bad. You know, his demeanor is way down. It's like he's broken.
A second search warrant is issued, and officers swarm Gacy's ranch-style home and immediately search the crawl space.
Charge him.
Is it pieced?
No. This body's been here too long. I think this whole crawl space is full of kids.
At that point, I placed Gacy under arrest for murder.
Gacy makes a full confession.
John's reaction to a murder charge, unbelievably, was pretty stoic.
Gacy confessed to killing kid after kid, but he always blamed the victim.
In all, Gacy admits to killing 33 young men and disposing of their bodies.
After he killed his victims, he would stick their underwear down their throat, and he actually buried 27 bodies in the crawl space below his house.
John Bukovich was under the cement in the garage, and Rob Peast, along with others, were dumped in the river.
And many times he said he killed two at a time. He would get two people incapacitated and kill one young man in front of the other one. And then he would kill the second person.
Why?
During the confession, he says there were times when I actually incapacitated the kids and I was able to leave them alone because they couldn't move. And I would go and change into a clown outfit, which he deemed the bad clown. And it was a very disturbing looking clown. And he said he would torture the kids a little bit more. And then as dressed up as the bad clown, he would kill them.
The rope trick was that he would tie one little very loose knot around the neck. He would have a stick. And then just on the other side of the stick, he would tie another very loose knot. And the stick was long enough to go between the shoulder and the head of the victim. And he would just start twisting it to compress around the neck and basically strangle the victim. One of the statements he gave to me was that, you know, Mike, I'm not going to spend a day in jail for this. And he gave him, but he was going to use insanity defense. Surprised, and he asked me about Gacy and his mental status. I don't think Gacy was crazy at all. He was just plain evil.
The public watches in horror as body after body is removed from Gacy's home. And when the killer clown goes to trial, macabre details of his crimes are revealed to the world. On December 22, 1978, John Wayne Gacy confesses to police that within the last 6 years, he has killed more than 30 young men and boys. The frigid Chicago winter weather can't keep the hordes of media outlets from staking out John Wayne Gacy's house. Every day brings new headlines and startling revelations.
CHF of Forensic Sciences, Edward Pavlik.
You know, there was another body discovered, or another body is brought out, or three bodies were brought out. And every night they had a situation where they were doing the tallies.
The number of bodies found today are 6.
Bringing the total to
21.
Gacy draws a map of the crawl space where bodies can be found. The excavation only pauses when the ground becomes too frozen to dig.
We went through 200 sets of dental records. So it was a mass undertaking, and every week we would get another 3 or 4 or 5, and we'd have to go ahead and make a decision whether these were consistent and possible identifications.
On April 9th, 1979, a body is found floating in the Des Plaines River. It is positively identified as Rob Peast. Gacy pleads not guilty by reason of insanity to 33 counts of murder. Due to the media attention in the Chicagoland area, finding an impartial jury for Gacy's trial is a challenge. As a result, the jury is selected from the northern Illinois city of Rockford. Two witnesses who testify against John Wayne Gacy are surviving victims Robert Donnelly and Jeffrey Rignall.
It was a brutal trial. Donnelly and Jeff Rignall both took the stand, and Rignall was so upset during his testimony that he vomited.
After only 2 hours of deliberation, the jury returns with a verdict: guilty on all counts. John Wayne Gacy is sentenced to death.
The trial was so emotional that everyone was crying at the end. The judge, the jurors, everyone but John Wayne Gacy.
I never hated Gacy, but I sure wanted him to get the death penalty. If he didn't get the death penalty, then nobody should get it.
Gacy continues to garner media attention while incarcerated.
In prison, Gacy began to paint, and this morbid market for his paintings began.
Gacy's execution, scheduled on May 10, 1994, draws crowds. Inside the prison, John Wayne Gacy eats his last meal of Kentucky Fried Chicken and is then escorted to the death chamber. Gacy is then executed via lethal injection.
Gacy's final words were, "Kiss my ass."
One of the mothers of one of the victims, Greg Godzik's mother, she died before Gacy did. And that was kind of hard to take. She never, satisfaction, whatever you want to call it, was able to see Gacy actually suffer for what he did to her.
It's been decades since his heinous crimes, and to this day, there are bodies that have not yet been identified.
As people continue to investigate the John Wayne Gacy case, there is potential evidence that suggests Gacy didn't act alone.
Gacy does mention there were others who had keys to his place. It seems unlikely that all these bodies can be buried under his house and these workers not know anything about it.
Likewise, there is speculation that Gacy possibly buried victims' bodies underneath the apartment building where his mother lived.
I got involved in the case because a retired detective had a story that I thought was interesting and said that he had seen John Wayne Gacy at 3 in the morning with a shovel. And I talked to a kid who had worked for John Wayne Gacy. I talked to a neighbor, and they had similar stories that Gacy was digging holes in the middle of the night, which seemed very odd at this apartment building.
Decades later, the investigation lingers as families of the missing continue to hope for answers.
There are some people who would like to see that property be dug up to just know once and for all if there are any other victims buried there. I'm not sure we'll ever get all the answers, but it makes you want to push to find some of these answers to at least try and get some closure for some families.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Murder Made Me Famous. Don't forget to subscribe at podcast1.com with the Podcast One app or at Apple Podcasts. Then go to reels.com, that's reelz.com, for clips, extras, and more from the TV version of the series, including chilling reenactments and crime scene photos that you'll only see on Reels Channel. Find Reels on your TV or at reels.com. I'm Steve Helling.
Hey, Jordan here. I know a lot of you create your own podcasts, and a lot of you already have one like me. I obviously love what I do. It's taken a lot of hard work to get to this point of success. You shouldn't have to pay fees for platform hosting, distribution, analytics, or fees to create a podcast. You need to be able to focus on producing the best show possible. Now, Podcast One, that's a network I'm on, they have Launchpad Digital Media, or Launchpad DM for short. So it's free, includes unlimited hosting, full control of distribution. You have access to a full dashboard with analytics. Again, totally free. You own everything, by the way. You own your content, you own your subscribers, no tricky stuff there. And you get your own show page on launchpaddm.com for people to listen to and subscribe to your show. It's the only hosting platform brought to you by the leading network, Podcast One. Podcast One will promote the site, drive people to discover your podcast, and if your show grows, You could even be invited to join Podcast One's all-star roster, which includes people like Adam Carolla, Caitlin Bristow, Shaq, Lady Gang, and of course, me, Jordan Harbinger. I'm there too. You also get access to their production and sales support. So with all this completely free, don't use other hosting platforms. Why would you need to? Learn more or sign up now at launchpaddm.com. And don't forget to check out The Jordan Harbinger Show.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.